This is Get a Real Job, the podcast devoted to people who choose risk over safe bets, who pursue their passion against all odds and are doing what they want, how they want, despite people and sometimes the voices in their own heads telling them they're nuts.
When the field that I wanted to work in didn't exist, I created it.
The only thing you have to decide is how hard do you want to work.
I really never went into the design of the restaurant of not succeeding. One way or another, I was going to succeed.
I'm your host, Dan Bova, editorial director of Entrepreneur.com. Thanks for listening. And now, get a real job. When it comes to one-named legends, you've got Madonna in music, Michael in sports, and then you've got today's guest, Todd in comic books. The Todd I'm referring to is Todd McFarlane, who revolutionized drawing iconic characters, namely Spider-Man, in the late 1980s, early 90s, and then went on to completely change the universe of collectible toys. He's the creator of Spawn, the longest-running creator-owned superhero comic book series of all time, and he's on the line. Welcome, Todd.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I am doing great, and great to connect with you. Fan of so much of your work, so really awesome to talk to you and pick your brain a little bit.
Oh, so you got a little geek in you, do you?
A little bit.
So, yeah, that's good. I think it's good, especially during this complicated past year.
Yes.
Having our internal interests, I think, are very valuable.
So I couldn't agree more. And for the casual comic book fans out there, you know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit, if we could jump right into, you know, what made you stand out so much when I said that about the late 1980s, early 90s with Spider-Man? You kind of you broke a lot of boundaries and a lot of barriers when you picked up that pen.
Yeah. Look, at any time somebody comes along and does something different, you know, you usually get a label on you. If it works, then they call you a genius. If it doesn't, then you're like a reckless rebel.
Right. Okay.
But you know, because most people will sort of come into their job and be very good stewards of status quo. And then those of us that, for whatever reason, it's just, I think we come out of the womb this way, that, you know, try to push the boundaries of it. You know, when it works, when it works, then people sort of say nice things. But all along the journey, they're trying to discourage you from it. So for me, how does that play out? You know, I'm a young kid, you know, born in Canada, coming to the big city, New York, and you know, trying to break into comic books after a couple years of being rejected hundreds of times. I finally get my first break, and they give you some low-level book, and eventually, if you can keep deadlines and improve your drawing skills, because I came as an artist, then they sort of, the raise isn't really money. The raise is they give you characters that people have known. Mm-hmm. So the first one I probably did was the Hulk. And then all of a sudden, that was when my mom and dad thought I'd made it, because they're like, well, we've heard of the Hulk. So this must be legit now, Todd.
Yeah.
You're okay. That whole, you're going to squander your life of being an artist, like, oh, you're doing the Hulk. We're okay. We can say that. We can say that at our next party and not be laughed at. But then eventually, I was doing the Hulk. I got faster. I could do a couple books. So I jumped on to... you know, I went into the Spider-Man office. They had sort of warded me away from it because they said it was a bit of a mess. And so, you know, being sort of cantankerous and always trying to push against everything, I went, they don't want me to go in the Spidey office. I'm going. And it was, they were having a tough time keeping talent. I think they had three different Spider-Man books at that point. And even the big book called Amazing Spider-Man, the one that Stan Lee created in the early 60s with Steve Ditko, then that book had fallen out of the top 20 in sales. I mean, it was floundering. And so they were looking for something. So, you know, I came in, I was at that point starting to garner a little bit of attention because of some of the stuff I was doing on the Hulk at that point. And I came in and just sort of went, yeah, sure, Spider-Man. Everybody knows Spider-Man. It'd be cool. But got this black costume on at the time. And I went, that's not really that interesting to me. Can we get the classic uniform back? The byproduct of that was we took the costume off and I did a design and worked on a story with the writer that became a character called Venom. So it was this happy accident that ended up being worth $1 billion to Marvel and Sony because I was too stubborn to draw Spider-Man in the black costume. Most, I think at that point, most young kids would have walked in going, I'm drawing Spidey. I'll draw him naked if you want. But I was like, I'm not drawing Spider-Man in the black costume. I need the red and blue. I need the webs. But for me, what struck me about Spider-Man was, especially because they said it was, you know, the sales weren't good. So that to me was an invitation. Maybe they didn't mean it to basically do what you could to help get the sales up. And so I started messing with some of the visuals, and to me, I didn't think it was that big of a deal, right? I in its simplest form, for people who don't read comic books, the way I describe it is they're doing Spider-Man, and the emphasis was on the word man. And when I started drawing it, I flopped that, and I started making the big majority on the word spider. So as soon as Peter Parker put on the costume, to me, he became this little sort of creepy, crawly guy. And so I put him in poses that nobody had done. I added more webbing to his costume. I helped, you know, invent this sort of way of him doing the webs, because the webs, literally up to that point, were not conducive to, I thought, sort of 3D, the illusion of 3D, and even more importantly, shooting the webs towards camera, because it looked ridiculous. So and then I changed what Mary Jane has, you know, one of the characters looked like. Made, she was a supermodel, so, you know, instead of making her dress like she was going to Kmart every day, I made her look like she was going to Saks. And you know, here's what was happening. The character had been in, I thought, in an artistic freeze from about 65 till time I got on in the late 80s. And all I did was just bring them up to the 80s and 90s. That's all I did. But because nobody had been doing that for 20, 25 years, it was a bit of a shock to the system. And so, and then I found out later that it's like, oh my God, he's on the checks. He's on the stock reports, you know, cause that was a public company, and they had sort of a definite look, and I was messing with the icon. And so all of a sudden trouble, you know, I become the troublemaker because I'm going outside the customary look of a character. So, but now, you know, to follow that up, what was happening was that the more I was sort of playing around with it, the more the sales were going up. And at some point, you know, it was, the conversation was, you don't have to like my artwork. You hired me to get the sales up with my writer, and we're now, you know, the second best-selling book at your company. So I don't understand why I keep coming into the office and you guys keep wagging a finger at me, because I'm just doing the job you gave me, which was to sell more comic books. Right. So
it's, you know, it sounds like you're telling like the comic book version of like Howard Stern. You know, like, you know, you're driving sales up, the audience loves it, but like the big wigs are losing their shit.
I think I'm telling the story that's as old as man.
Yeah.
what I've found in my life, and I sometimes I go and I talk to the kids at the university and stuff, that I from my perspective, I warn them that I think the biggest enemy you're going to meet in your life is status quo. And you're going to meet it multiple times. And what that means is you're going to have systems and more frustrating people who are going to adhere to the status quo. over and over and over, because anything that becomes change, there's a attitude of, well, what if it doesn't work? This is the glass half empty, right? And the true entrepreneur never, ever thinks of failure on any level. So to me, it was foreign to go, well, why would I do anything I think is not going to work, right? But because there's so many people reliant on the status quo of that business model, that you, and we've seen it before, that you can get lazy. So IBM, they think they're the smartest people on the blocks, and you got this little guy, Steve Jobs, and a couple of his friends in a garage, and they go, you know, man, you know, we got this other idea, and they're like, they laugh at them, but eventually the giants fall in love with their ideas, and innovation starts to wane, and then somebody else always comes along and does it slightly different. Here's the thing. I think there's only sort of three constants in life, right? We know the first two, death and taxes, right? Like, so those are coming. And then the only other one since the dawn of man has been change. That's the only, otherwise we'd all be in caves right now.
Right.
And change is a constant. And yet every day of our life, there are millions of us that run into the wall of status quo. Don't change this. Keep doing what happened yesterday. Don't think about tomorrow. And it's bizarre to a guy like me and many others over time. We don't get it. We don't get like what, and we're not saying that what you're doing is bad. Here's the piece. They thought at Marvel that because I wasn't drawing Spider-Man the way they had done it, I thought that their version was bad. And I was going to show them up. It had nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with it. I was just doing a fun way that I thought would be cool for the readers of that time that would help in sales. And in the long run, it proved that I was more correct than they were. And it, like, I had nothing to do with what you had done before. It was just, this is 1990s, right? We don't wear bell bottoms anymore. I don't dislike bell bottoms. I don't hate bell bottoms. Just nobody's wearing bell bottoms. This is the fashion that we're wearing. This is today's modern fashion.
Right.
So don't, why are you guys being so personal about this?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to do bell bottoms, right? Like, it's weird. But anyway, eventually it just, you know, here's the funny part before I tell you the why I quit. I fought against them the whole time. Todd, stop doing that. Todd, stop. And so I did what every sort of rebel does, is that you shake your head and you say, yes, sir, I'll stop. And then I never did.
Right.
And then each time they caught on that I was basically fibbing, each time they brought me into the office, the sales had gone higher. And at some point they have to give up the ghost of that you don't have to like what I'm doing. But, oh, by the way, they even created a new Spider-Man book for me that I could write and draw myself, that ended up setting a record that's still a record today for a single creator. And I did all those things. And at the end of it, when they just finally frustrated me too much, I go, I got to get out of here. Thanks, but no thanks. And I left Marvel Comics. There are still things in the way that Spider-Man is drawn today that still are reminiscent of my style, which I find completely ironic.
Yeah.
Given that they fought me the whole time.
Yeah.
And what I keep saying is, why don't you let the next kid come along and add what he wants? Because he might be doing something that none of us know would resonate. Instead, now what you're doing is almost repeating the same act. It's just that now the new status quo look happens to be the look that I happen to lay down the blueprint on.
Right.
So,
right.
Which is weird. I become my own Frankenstein. So.
Well, so, you know, jumping ahead to you said you quit, you start your own thing, Spawn, which, as I said, is, you know, has a Guinness Book of World Record for the longest running, single character title. How do you
and the biggest sales? Remember, I said that Spider-Man book set a record.
Yeah.
Right. So that's I own the corporate record for a single creator on a book. And then when I left, we started Spawn, and Spawn number one, I owned the non-corporate record. I owned the record on both sides of that fence.
For first issues.
Yeah.
So pretty good. Pretty good. So now how do you guard against what you were coming up against? So now you are running, your own operation. How do you guard against becoming, as you said, complacent?
This one's easy. This one's easy for a guy like me. Number one, I never go public, right? Mm. Because public forces, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but everybody that's at a public company, especially those that are high up, have this term called the fiduciary responsibility, which is to maximize shareholder value, which basically means get as much profits as you can. And those decisions are not necessarily conducive at all times to both innovation and or creativity and basically trying things. What you do is you go, hey, we're making money. Why if it ain't broke, why fix it? And that's why innovation, the guy in the garage will come out with an idea and all of a sudden get it to market and catch up to you, because you got lazy counting dollars. So number one, didn't go public. And number two, even the money that I made was of less interest to me than the art, right? I tell people that I'm bilingual now, right? I started as an artist and I'm bilingual. I now know business. I learned the language of business. I can do it fluently. Is it my first language? No. Would it be my first choice? No. But if I have enough success on the business side that I help drive, that allows me to do the artwork that I see fit, that's the victory every day.
Yeah.
So, and oh, by the way, I found I engineer backwards, that if you put out a good product at a fair price, people will usually respond to it, and the byproduct is money. And so what a lot of companies do is they start with the money first. They look at their spreadsheet and they say, hey, we need to make $35 million profit on this toy line. So we're going to make, 200 units, different units at varying prices. And then they do all the calculations. And then the last thing on that whole spreadsheet, they go all the way down, is now the people that are actually going to make the toy. And they go, finally, they get down to the artist and they say, oh, yeah, by the way, remember that toy you were making that you were making for a buck, a pop? We need you to do it this year for 92 cents. Thank you. Click. And they hang up the phone and they send the email. And now the creative people are sort of at the end of the line. I when I started my toy company, I did the opposite. Make the best toy you could make. Price it at a fair price, and people hopefully will see the value on it. So the Fortune 500 companies at that point, which are still here, companies like Hasbro and Mattel that I go up against every day in my life. I think when I came in, toys were like action figures, which is what I mostly do. They were like $5.99 if you walked into a Target or Walmart. And mine came out at $6.99. Mm-hmm. And they were all a flutter going, Todd, I remember some of them in my first toy fair. Todd, little boy, you can't, toys are $5.99 action figures. You can't sell $6.99 product to people. And the answer is like, of course you can. Of course you can. And here's how I know you can sell $6.99, because people spend a quarter of $1 million on a house.
Right.
And then they spend $30,000 on a car, and they'll spend $250 on an Xbox. Of course they will, as long as they think they're getting the value in return for it.
Right.
So what you're making the mistake about, Mr. Fortune 500 company, is that you want to make a $5.99 toy and sell it for $6.99. You're right. They won't buy that. My model is I'm going to make a toy that I think looks like it's worth $8.99, maybe $9.99, and I'm going to sell it for $6.99. And of course I can sell that.
Right.
I'm just going to give them value for it. So you do your model, I'll do mine. I don't have the same pressures and overhead that you guys have. I can just put my time and effort into the product, which is ultimately what the consumer gets. and give them as much value as possible, and they'll keep coming back. And oh, by the way, they keep coming back. You make a dollar here, you make a dollar there. And now for me, I've been doing it for 30 years on my own. So like, that's my victory. My victory is I don't have to work for the corporations. I'm a free man every day of my life for the last 30 years.
That's awesome. And for people, you know, people who go and buy action figures now, you know, they're accustomed now to seeing like, oh yeah, that's that guy from that movie. But, you know, when you started, and I'm old enough to remember this, you know, back in the day, our action figures like kind of vaguely sort of looked like the guy from the movie. But you came in and you made these like super detailed, super realistic, super in sync with what the thing actually looked like. And did you was that an epiphany to you, or is that something that you always wanted to do? Like, where did you come up with that concept of, hey, let's make these look really good?
I think I was probably the 400 millionth person who came up with that idea, right? Okay. I think we go in and we buy products and we always wonder, you know, why can't it be better? I wasn't the first guy to sit there and say that. You know, I walk up and down a toy aisle as an artist, especially. My simple question was, I don't understand why toys can't look cooler, right? Mm-hmm. And then eventually, we started our a company called Image Comics, and out of that came the Spawn comic. Well, then what happened was then the Fortune 500 companies and the public companies came, the toy companies came and said, hey, Todd, we see that Spawn is the number one selling comic book, which at that point it was. And so they go, hey, we want to make toys and pillowcases and pajamas and all the things that they normally want to, you know, sort of make ancillary out of. And one of the categories was toys. And so I had a conversation with almost every single one of those companies, and more. And I said, here's how I think we'll be able to sell Spawn. First off, have you read a Spawn book? Because I'm telling you, if you read a Spawn book, you're not going to want to put them on pajamas.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you right
now. Thinking the same thing.
Yes. Like, oh, no. When I made them go read the book, a lot of those people didn't come back. They're like, duh, we're not putting this on pillowcases. You know, because the Spawn's a little bit, you know, a lot darker and grittier than, you know, your average comic book.
He's Spawn from hell is just for people who.
Right. Yeah. So, like, I don't know if people need a little hell things. but they want to make toys because it was the biggest selling comic book. And they were going, hey, it's outselling Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, might as well. And my thing to them was, here's how I think it'll work. I think we need to make a slightly non-traditional toy, and we need to sell it in non-traditional places and non-traditional ways. That's, you know, basically tweaking the status quo. And unfortunately, and I get it, that they just went, no, we have this way of doing our business. We're going to sort of put it through the same grinder we do, you know, any sort of cute Teletubby or Disney product. And then we're going to put your product right next to them on the shelf and price it at the same and do the same sort of research and development on it. And to me, I go, it's going to fail. It's going to fail if you put it through the vanilla blender. And so I just, at some point, walked away from all of them, made a couple phone calls, and then asked the question, how hard is it to make a toy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's plastic. We're not talking about nuclear physics. We're talking about plastic in a shape, right? So I got a quick education, and then I started my own toy company. And very quickly, to your point, people were like going, oh my God, Todd, like, man, look at this. And here's what we did. You mentioned a couple of them. We got them to be realistic. We got them to look like whatever was the brand that we were getting, and we put a bunch of paint on it, and just made it high quality. And oh, by the way, if you're going to do something, you know, that's based on the character Aliens or Predator or a baseball player or whatever, you might not necessarily be selling that to a 5-year-old. So I wasn't concerned that, you know, I was selling to moms and 5-year-olds. I was selling it to people that were going to have, I thought, a more discriminating eye at the consumer level. And so I was going to have to get it right. Because if I didn't, it was going to be a failure. So like 92% of what I sell goes into the hands of people 14 and older, right? So I'm not selling the kids. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of them go into the hands of adults. So of course I had to get it right. Now,
more coming up from our guests, but first, a word from our sponsor.
Hey, everybody. So hoping these conversations are getting you all fired up to finally start that business you always wanted to launch, or maybe take that side hustle to the next level. But maybe you need just a little more inspiration and information to kind of push you over the edge. Well, that's why I want to talk to you about Entrepreneur Insider. Entrepreneur Insider is a program that we have at entrepreneur.com that is geared to do all of that and more. It's a membership-based program that provides insights and advice from industry experts with exclusive benefits. Let me tell you about those benefits. When you join, you get access to premium articles, videos, webinars, really good webinars, I should add. These are not boring, put you to sleep slideshows. These are great experts that have really, really sharp advice that you can listen to and use them like 10 minutes later. It's really good stuff. You also get a weekly newsletter and you get an ad-free experience when you go to entrepreneur.com. Plus, you get a free one-year subscription to Entrepreneur Magazine, that paper thing that you could carry around and you never have to plug in to recharge. Really great articles every month, really awesome pictures. And sometimes it's nice to just read something on paper, I have to say, from my personal opinion. So, how much does it cost to join Entrepreneur Insider? It's only $5 a month. If you join today, you start boosting your business knowledge, growing your brand, you get access to all these great things. And seriously, those webinars, they're really, really good. I heartily recommend you doing it just for that. And also the magazine, really cool stuff. So if you are interested, and I know you are because you could hear the pleading in my voice that this is actually a really cool deal, visit entrepreneur.com/insider to unlock your access today. That's entrepreneur.com/insider. Unlock your access, get going, get fired up. Do it today. And we're back.
How did I get it right? And how did we do it? And we've won a bunch of awards for our quality and our realism and all those other ones. I keep saying the same thing. I've said it for years. You're asking me the wrong question. The question isn't, how did I get it right? The question is, how did they get it wrong for decades?
Mm.
Because the way I got it right, especially when we were doing like movie stars and you know, we were doing all four sports, football, baseball, basketball, and hockey, all the major sports. And the reason I was able to make it look exactly like them is because I was using this technology and if some of the people on the phone here don't quite understand it, you can Google it after. It's called a camera. And if you take a camera and you push a button, that gives you a photo. And if you take your clay and you keep messing with the clay until it looks exactly like the photo from the camera, then it looks exactly. And so people go, how did you do it? The question isn't, how did I do it? The camera existed a long time, ladies and gentlemen. How did they not do it, given that there was photos and cameras? That's the bigger one. But I also have words of advice for people. If you want to look smart, hang around dumb people. Or if you want to look like you're really good at math, hang around a bunch of kindergartners, right? Just, it depends on the people around you. So God bless the methodology of the big toy makers for being lazy, and somebody comes along that's not lazy, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, look at what he's doing. They could have done it for 50 years. They could have done it for 50 years. They chose not to.
Oh my God, that's great. Camera. Write that down, people. I've never heard of
it. Yes, Google it.
That's fantastic. You know, one of the things that I love, you're obviously pretty passionate about what you do, Todd. But one of the things that I love you're so big on social media and you love teaching the way you draw. I would recommend anyone who has any interest, even if you're not don't want to learn. Just, it's very entertaining just to watch you create these things out of thin air. And I wonder, you know, what is social media and putting those videos up? Like, what does that mean to you? Why do you do it? Is it just fun? What's going on there?
Well, social media is a big visual. You play up on the visual. So people like to look at pictures and stuff, right? So you try to entertain them with your art as much as possible. The interesting thing is that when I'm at conventions, right, and I do panels, and maybe I disappoint people, but, you know, they think I'm going to sit there and talk about comic books. And I rarely these days talk about comic books. What I talk about is how to assert yourself, like, with your work and your business and your passions and like, forget, because everybody's not going to be an artist. Everybody's not going to be a comic book person. So I try to, like, apply and give, like, fight for yourself, right? Mm. Fight for yourself and go out there and do it. And, you know, and it's frustrating. And if I go back and I talk to a lot of creative people, that they're shy about showing their artwork because it's like they might get rejected. Right. It's like, what are you talking about? You think Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks walked into Hollywood and said, I want to be a leading man. Otherwise I'm not going to take any job. Like, no, right. I bet you they got rejected 100 times. Then they finally got a job for being maybe one of the extras in the background. Then eventually they got to be close to the camera. Then they gave them one speaking part and then they became a character. And then eventually they got, like, if you can't take negative input, then you're not sort of built for it. But I'll tell you how to get past the negative. Assume they're going to say no, and you'll never be wrong. You'll never be wrong. And so you go there, and they'll reject you, and you'll just go, I knew it. Cool. You know, and then they'll reject you again. You go, I knew it. And then pretty soon you'll be rejected 20 times in a row. You'll be on a hot streak. It'll be like the Cal Ripken Jr. of no's. And then here's the problem. The day they break your streak, and you should be feeling good about that streak because you called it for 20 times in a row. And then the day that they break their streak, you know what happens? They said yes.
Yeah.
And so you're disappointed that they broke your streak, but you got a yes and you got a job out of it in return. So what ends up happening, I found through most people, is that they set the bar too high. Mm. They think they're going to get every job and every interview. And I'm like, no. That's your mom. Set the bar high. Absolutely not. Set the bar low, because low bars are really easy to get over. So number one, assume the answer is going to be no, you will never be disappointed. And number two, every morning you get up, assume the world is going to be far from perfect, and you will never be disappointed. If you actually think the opposite, like somebody sent me a nasty email and somebody cut me off in traffic and somebody said something I didn't like, I'm like, wow. So you actually got up today and you thought the world was going to be perfect.
Yeah.
Wow. Shame on you. You're setting yourself up for a fall and it will crush you every time you get rejected.
Right.
You know, that at some point you just have to just go look at no individual. We have 8 billion people on this planet. There is not one of those people that woke up this morning and said, you know what my goal is today? I'm going to make Todd McFarlane's life better. That's like, shoot, that's what I'm going to do today. That's my goal. Like, no, there's only one human being that had that goal today. And that was me.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't understand when I meet shy people who don't want to advocate for themselves, that it's like, I got to tell you, if you don't get up and advocate for you, and you're you, what other human being do you think should advocate for you?
Right.
Because, oh, by the way, whoever that person is, they can't even get you on their team.
Right.
So why would they even spend that energy?
Mm.
Right? Like,
yeah.
It's weird. And I'm not saying that you have to be sort of confident and competitive and arrogant and whatever word you want to apply to a guy like me. But I'm saying that you got to put your shyness aside at times to basically assert and fight for yourself. Because if you don't, it's going to be a long, long, long life, right? Like, come on. And what's the worst that happens? I tell every one of my employees, every day of your life, you should walk in my office and ask for a raise. Every day. Because I'm probably going to say no every day. But what happens if what happens one day you catch me when I'm just busy and I'm like, yeah, fine. Fine. You have your raise. Right?
Has that ever happened?
A couple of them. A couple of them are pretty good. But the others are like, think I'm like, it's a joke. But I'm like, no. And I admire those people. The young ones will go, you told me to come in every day. And I'm like, I go, I like you. I like the answer still no. The answer still no, but I like the attitude. But at some point, if you're not sort of fighting for what you enjoy, what you want, like no one's going to do you any favors, nor should anybody do you any favors. So, okay. And it's why I started my companies. Cause I go, nobody owes me a living. Nobody owes me, you know, the satisfaction of doing art the way I see fit. Nobody needs to give me and spend their money so that I can do something that's in my head. There's only one person needs to do that. That's me. And so, and then the upside of all that is that when you fail, and I failed many times, that I can live with it, because at the end of the day, when I sort of try to get mad and go, whose fault was this? Who started all this? And then I go, it's the guy I shave with in the morning. And I kind of like that guy, right? And if I don't, I can't get away from him anyways. So I'm stuck with me. So I don't know. It's what comes natural for some people isn't natural for others. So I've found as I've gotten older, being an entrepreneur is just, it's either in your DNA or it's not. I don't think you can actually create it. I coach sports, especially baseball, at a very high level. I played at a high level myself, and I'm always telling the parents, I go, there's three things I can't teach your kid. I can't teach your kid to throw harder, because every guy in the major would be throwing 300 miles an hour.
Right.
I can't teach them to run faster, because they'd all be running like Usain Bolt. And I can't teach them to care. Mm. Either they care and they're going to want to hustle, or they don't. And you yelling from the sidelines or me doing it, no, you either got a fire in your belly or you don't.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, it can't be put into you, which is okay. I'm not saying everybody has to be a sort of a warrior, right? I mean, some dogs bite and some dogs don't. And you can't take a dog that doesn't bite and teach them to bite, because they're just nice, kind dogs, right? So, okay. But if you're going to be an entrepreneur, then you have to be fearless and at times reckless. And you have to be ready to get bloodied. And you have to sort of be humbled about four or five times along the way. And then you just have to find just enough success that you can have your little corner of bliss. So I'm not trying to put Hasbro out of business, or Mattel. I'm not trying to put DC comic books or Marvel comic books out of business. I'm not trying to do any of that. All I want to do is coexist next to them and not be in a position where they can put me out of business, which they can. And just do my thing. And then hopefully do that for another 40 more years, and then possibly die at 102, right? So that's the goal.
That's pretty good. So you mentioned, you know, so your former place of employment, and so when you look at the state of comic books, and in particular comic book movies, because I know you're or I've read that you're talking about, you know, another Spawn movie. You know, do you look at what Marvel's up to or DC is up to, and what do you see them doing that you think, you know, I would do that differently?
So you always want to be aware of your competition, because either you have to better them at it or you have to do something different. Those are your only two options, right? And the 800-pound gorillas, I don't suggest you try to do it better, because they just have too much at their disposal. What you can do is find what they're not doing and do something different, add something different to it. And so the big, obviously the big superhero movies, especially on the Marvel side, are hugely successful. And if I'm Disney at this point, Disney owns Marvel, why would I change that formula when you're making billions of dollars every year off the formula? I wouldn't. So what I have to do is say, hey, if we're going to make a movie, a Spawn, and it's going to be a lower budget. And why is it going to be a lower budget? Because I've told them that I'm going to direct it. So I'll be starting a new career here in my, I'll be in a month, I'll be 60. So I'll be starting a new career at 60. I'll be a director. will I do more than one? I'll tell you after I do the first one, whether I actually enjoyed it or not. But the only way I can get them to sign off and me being a first-time director is if the budget isn't wildly out of control, because they're not going to invest that much money in a first-time director. Right. So it has to be a low budget. So if it's going to be a low budget, let's say 20, 25 million compared to a quarter of a billion for a Marvel movie, then I would be an absolute fool to try and do a watered-down version of a $250 million movie, because you can't compete. Mm-hmm. So you have to do something that is different. In my case, you know, it's, well, instead of looking at the superheroes as your model, look at like horror movies, because those are generally a lower budget. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, they have some things that sort of can scare people and get people sort of excited and talking about, but you don't have a tremendous amount of computer generated, you know, right, effects on the screen and whatever else. You've got, you know, some cool moments, and hopefully people go, oh, that was worth my 2 hours. And usually those movies come out in between the blockbusters, right? Like during that October, September, January, February time or whatever else. So I've acknowledged, I've been doing the character of Spawn since 1992, almost 30 years, and so, which is how we got to that record of 301 issues that we just got certified from Guinness Book of World Record. That it took, you know, almost 30 years to get there. There's no shortcut. And now I am acknowledging that within those 30 years that a portion of my fans have grown up with me. So they're not kids. So yeah, they can go to an R-rated movie. So
right.
I'll do a R-rated creepy dark movie that will hopefully scare the crap out of you and push you back in your seat from time to time, and not worry about trying to compete and do a big superhero movie. That's another formula.
That's great. Well, super smart. Not surprising, but that's a brilliant approach, I think. So if you were, starting out young Todd McFarlane, starting out today in today's marketplace, like, what would you do differently, or would you do it differently? Like, for the kids out there, for the young folks, you know, what's your advice for day one?
Well, if you're asking me personally, a little bit of be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah.
I don't know with hindsight on my side, I would have started a toy company, because that's a lot of work, right?
Yeah, okay.
So I was like, oh, let's just do a bunch of cool stuff. And it's like, wow, there's a whole mechanism that goes to making toys and delivering them to a store like Walmart. So, silly me for being naive, thinking that it was just going to be fun. The young Todd, I don't know. I mean, if anybody that here's what I would say to anybody that's young, whatever your idea is, whatever it is that you think you want to do, on your own. And number one, people are going to say, spend somebody else's money. I'm here as an advocate to say that nobody's ever spent their own money who has ever said that. If it's possible, beg, borrow, and steal all the money you need so that it's your money, so you get to make the decisions, so you're not beholden to somebody else. And then that way, you don't have to sort of start making compromises so early in the game. You're going to eventually have to get there. You're there. But the big one is, the biggest failure I've seen, and we know what the data is of small businesses and what that failure rate is. And as I've sort of observed small businesses over the past few decades, the one thing that I've seen that I would say is probably the biggest error that even my own friends and some family members have done is that they come up with the idea, they put the prospectus together, you know, they lay it all out. They even go and do their budget, and they calculate like what's going to be the overhead, and here's my cost, and here's, you know, what the cost of goods are going to be, and this is the profit I need to make, and how many people I'm going to have to hire, and this is going to be medical, like all of it, right? A good spreadsheet should cover all of it. And then they come down and they go, oh my gosh, I'm going to make cupcakes. And if I sell 1,000 cupcakes at $5, then it all works. And so we're off to the races. Here's the mistake of that. I only have one question. Once you present that to me, I only have one question. Do you know of any store within 100 miles of you that sells 1,000 cupcakes in a month? I understand your spreadsheet says if you sell 1,000, mm-hmm. that it works. I only have one question. Does anybody do that? If it was me, what I would do, whatever you're interested in, I would find the best person, company, small business that does exactly or close to what it is that you want to compete in. And I would go to that company. Let's stick with cupcakes. I'd find the best small cupcake place in the entire Phoenix area, which is where I live, which is, you know, close to 4 million people. And I would sit outside of their store with a clicker for a month. And I would click how many cupcakes were coming out that door. And I would add up, because at the end of the day, if the best and most popular place in Phoenix is only selling 600 mm-hmm. cupcakes a month,
right.
then your 1,000 sales a month is dead on arrival. You're going to go into business. You're going to spend a lot of time and effort, and you're going to find that your overhead is going to crush you within 8 to 12 months, and you're going to be out of business.
Mm.
So just take the one more step and see if you can replicate it anywhere else. Is it being replicated anywhere else? And then if it is, then you go, okay, but my cupcakes are going to taste better than theirs. Boom, you got a fighting chance, right? Mine are going to look prettier than theirs. Boom, you got a fighting chance. You're on to something else. And I'm going to price it 50 cents cheaper. Boom, you're on to, you got something. But don't put yourself in a position where you're just coming up with an idea, putting it on paper, and never actually seeing whether it actually exists in the real world.
That's awesome. I love that. And for anyone who sees Todd with a clicker outside of a bakery, don't call the cops. He's doing research.
I'm doing research. Good for you.
Well, this has been awesome and extremely enlightening. And I hope listeners, whatever their interest is, you've given some incredible, incredible advice. I've talked to a lot of people, and I don't think anyone's ever put it as plainly and simply and clearly as you have. So thank you for that.
Well, Can I add one more?
Yeah.
Everyone should be an entrepreneur once in their life. I think you should make the attempt, because if it fails, to me, it's like getting your hair cut. It'll grow back. You can always go back to the system, right? Wherever you're at right now, if you were to basically say, no, I'm going to take 2 years off and I'm going to go try something. If you fail miserably, I bet you can almost go right back to where you're at right now. You don't lose anything.
Mm.
You still have those same skill sets, but what if it doesn't fail? What if it actually works, right? That's the piece that it's like, I'm telling you, as somebody who's been on that side of the track, it's a good life. It's a good life to wake up and not have to get approval from somebody else in the world. You just get to do what you want to do. It's a good life.
That's awesome. Awesome advice. Todd, really, really awesome talking to you. As I said, I'm a genuine big fan of your art and what you've been able to accomplish, and can't wait to see what's next in store with the movies and the whole Spawn universe you've got going on. I think people are in for some treats.
Here's the funny thing. Although I'm 60, I still think I've got 40 more good years in me. I think I'm only halfway through this journey, right? So yeah. I like whatever people go, oh, look at all the stuff you've accomplished. I'm like, I'm only halfway through. This is a marathon. I'm only at the halfway point of the marathon right now. I still think my better days are way ahead of me. So it's okay. It keeps you youthful too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, man. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate your time. And again, all the advice. Great stuff.
Yeah. No, good luck to you. And hopefully somebody listening will be on your show someday in the future, because our job is to pay it forward and create the next generation.
That's our episode, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. Get a Real Job comes out every Tuesday, so be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you harvest your favorite podcasts. Leave us a review, give us a share. Don't make me beg, people. Go to entrepreneur.com for new episodes of this and to listen to our other great podcasts. Thanks.